The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Chris Catrone, welcome back to Zero Books. I'm going to probably post an intro in, but I'll just say you're the track coach for the Platypus Affiliated Society and an art historian and professor, and you teach critical theory as well. And you're becoming a regular guest on this podcast. And I'm glad to talk to you again. This is the first time you asked to come on rather than have me ask you to come on. And it was in response to the last video that I put up about Noah Berlatsky and class consciousness and Adorno and Lukács. That video was meant to be the beginning of a series of videos on the question of class consciousness and specifically Lukács, really, mm-hmm. More than Adorno.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't resist, because that was also born out of a Facebook encounter, and you know how people are on Facebook, including me, kind of an argument about Adorno that I engaged with a couple of people who were, I think, in the Platypus Affiliated Society. Hmm. And so this was my response to that exchange. You may not know that, but this a part of this critique of Adorno was a part of that debate.
And this reification arises in nearly every layer of society, perhaps especially within the struggle for socialism, or within Marxism itself. For example, in 1964, the father of critical theory, Theodor Adorno, gave a series of lectures attempting to lead students through an immanent critique of sociology and philosophy. In an aside, Adorno echoes the Communist Manifesto by claiming that the act of exchanging living labor for wages presupposes the class system. Now, this may sound similar to Marx's claim that in bourgeois society, living labor is but a means to increase accumulated labor. However, in the manifesto, Marx is referring to living labor as it is utilized by the bourgeois society as a whole, while Adorno is taking aim at the particular fact that the society is shaped by market exchanges. Adorno is making a more detailed political economic critique. He claims that if you have to sell yourself on the job market, you'll inevitably end up in a situation where you cannot actually realize your own possibilities and talent, but must largely follow what is demanded of you by a boss. On a level of what might be called lived experience, this is nearly a truism, but conceiving of the class dynamic inherent to the wage relation in terms of the exchange of living labor for a wage leads away from a deeper truth about class and about the bourgeois society from which it arises.
Time takes you beyond the news.
Time flies.
The bourgeois worldview is one wherein freedom and equality are synonymous. The notion of a fair day's labor for a fair day's work is justified on the basis of this notion of equality. That is, the labor is sought to be equal in value to the wage. Now, if this were true, then selling yourself on the job market would not presuppose a class system. However, the exchange of a worker's time for a wage is not really about exchanging what Adorno calls living labor for money, but rather it is an exchange of what Marx called labor power for money. One's labor power is one's ability to work, and it has a real price on the market. A fair enough price, as its value really is equal to its price. And the lowest wage you can get is a wage that equals the amount of money required to keep you fed, sheltered, clothed, and well enough to come to work the next day. The contradiction in the wage relation is not the fact that it is a hegemonic relation that one must participate in, but rather the contradiction arises from the difference between the value of labor power and the value produced by living labor. To be clearer and to step beyond the lingo, what this means is that real sensuous work produces commodities, and these commodities have value, but the living labor itself does not have any value or price. Labor power, the promise to arrive at work and to do your best, that has a value and a price. That is a formal contract, and this labor power is the one commodity a worker really owns. But it is a special kind of commodity because the use of the commodity, the use of labor power, is what creates the value used to set up all exchanges in the market. Adorno calls his position on the consciousness arising out of the exchange relation, as opposed to production for exchange, heretical, because Adorno says Marx believed that power could arise out of the formal contract for wages. Now, this is another way of saying that Marx believed that the working class as such could create a power capable of overturning capitalism. That is, on the one hand, Adorno is rejecting the idea that tailing after workers and their struggles as workers is sufficient for overcoming capitalism, but on the other, Adorno's notion of capitalism is one-sided. By ignoring what he calls an ideal, typical, and ahistorical model of capitalism, in favor of the psychological experience of immiseration and precarity, Adorno ends up, however briefly, reproducing what Lukács would call a reified consciousness. In his lecture, Adorno points to the truism of inequality and precarity to denounce what really amounts to the kind of generalized coercive quality that would arise out of any mediated social arrangement, rather than carefully analyzing the nature of commodity production and the logic that arises from it. So that's my critique of Adorno in that particular lecture. But in the next video, we'll continue on exploring Lukács' essay Reification and the Consciousness of the Proletariat as we struggle on to draw a connection between the commodity form and what we might call capitalist realism, or alternatively, the ideology of the ruling class.
I'm not surprised to know that you'd like to respond to my video and to offer some corrections, so I thought I might just give you an opportunity to start by voicing your objections and maybe asking me questions or however you wanted to proceed.
All right. Well, one thing that occurred to me when I was watching your video was, the difficulty of the concept of reification. My old professor, Moshe Postone, and also others such as the Marxist humanists have objected to the reification concept by Lukács and the critique of reification. Also, Gillian Rose talked about the lament over reification and criticized Lukács for basically the idea being that Lukács's discussion of reification seems to leave no way out. And so my reading of Lukács, which is, of course, affected on the one hand by my prior experience of Marxism, specifically Trotskyist Marxism, but also from the Frankfurt School, I always thought that commodity fetishism and reification, which is not exactly the same thing as commodity fetishism, but is related, a related concept, that these were dialectical concepts. In other words, that reification was meant to describe a self-contradiction in capitalism rather than be what Moshe Postone called a one-sided critique of capitalism. My background also, specifically with Adorno and Walter Benjamin, Adorno praises Benjamin's work for mobilizing what Adorno called critical reification. In other words, the reification could have a critical value and not just something to complain about, not just a pejorative connotation. I want to
jump in here and ask you to clarify a couple of things. One is, how are you understanding the term reification? How do you think Moshe Pistone thinks of the idea of reification?
Okay, so when I teach Lukács, and I teach Lukács as foundational for the Frankfurt School, you know, this specific Lukács, the early Marxist Lukács, you know, I zero in on this idea of thingification, reification as thingification, and really trace it back into the philosophical language of German idealism, the difference between a thing and an object. In other words, it's through the activity of the subject, both practically and theoretically, that the thing becomes an object. So we don't know the thing in itself, we only know it as an object in our practical and theoretical interaction with it. So the idea being that in a subject-object dialectic, the subject can recognize itself in the object. Whereas for Lukács, reification means that these things become divorced, that subject and object become split, and the subject can no longer recognize itself in the object. Okay. And that the object reverts into a thing.
Yeah, I just want to add a comment to that. One other way to think about that is when people fail to recognize their own activity as shaping their supposedly objective view of the world.
Yes.
They naturalize what are really social or subjective conditions that they've created.
That's right.
Not that those are not in some sense objective, because when you act on the world, you are shaping something outside of yourself, but you're nonetheless participating in the creation of the thing.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. And so the connotations of reification are a kind of petrification or ossification, as well as a naturalization and a hypostasization.
What's that last one mean?
Hypostasize, to take something and falsely attribute it as the foundation, as the ground for something. Mm-hmm. So to take something that's been elaborated and treat it like it's the basis. And sort of, again, kind of a like naturalization.
Yeah.
That's where there's an overlap with commodity fetishism.
Right.
Right. And so that's why I focus on the more literal meaning of the word thingification, to emphasize the subject-object dialectic and to, you know, capture what Lukács's finer point is, because he's making a kind of a finer point with reification. It's like a subset of commodity fetishism. It's not equivalent to commodity fetishism. It's like a specific phenomenon of commodity fetishism. And that's why, you know, his first part of the reification and the consciousness of the proletariat essay is called the phenomenon of reification.
And well, I emphasize wouldn't commodity that. Fetishism be like a subset of reification rather than the other way around? Like you could reify your conceptions of God in the feudal era, and that would be a reification, but it wouldn't be a reification based on the production of commodities, and therefore it would be a
difference. Well, that's where I think fetishism is, you know, captures the metaphysical subtleties and theological niceties, you know, the analogy with religion and with the religious cosmology. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's more about naturalization and hypostasization, because of course God's never reified, God's never a thing, right? God's always a kind of a subject, right? So it's a little bit different in that respect. You know, this is what, by the way, people associate the early Marxist Lukács with the early pre-Marxist Lukács, who's kind of a romantic and who sort of bemoans the absence of God, we might say. Mm-hmm. Now, just to get back to your original question, Moshe Pistone treats reification in Lukács as the quantification of the qualitative. And really focuses in on the liabilities of reification when approaching value theory from Marx's Das Kapital. And I think that that's not the move to make. In other words, there might be some problems with the rhetoric of reification in Lukács, but I don't think that the way you do that, you know, you address that is to say, well, it doesn't line up with value theory, because actually Lukács isn't talking about value theory. He's saying specifically, we're leaving the domain of economics and even leaving the domain of political economy, and we're looking rather at all the subjective and objective forms of bourgeois society and capitalism. And he uses other language that helps us clue into this, which is phantom-like objectivity, which is related to the phantasmagoria in the fetishism chapter of Capital, that it's a phantasmagoria, not a fantastical relation, but a phantasmagorical relation between things. So a phantom-like objectivity, meaning we can kind of see object, you know, the subject and the object, but it's elusive. And of course, this the main problem for Lukács is reified consciousness, right? So the idea that consciousness or subjectivity becomes thing-like, becomes thingified. In other words, we treat our own subjectivity as thingified.
Right. Can you give me an example, either from Lukács or from everyday life, where people might treat their subjectivity as thingified?
Rather than subjective practices, say. Right.
But their conceptions or their perceptions is reified. Is that what you mean?
I would say, why I always approach this as central to his critique of the Second International Revisionists and then ultimately Kautsky, is that the real example of reified consciousness, of a kind of thing-like subjectivity, would be, and corollary to a reified objectivity, would be to say the objective historical laws, right, and then to derive one's practice from a supposedly objective determination, right, of social circumstances. And so that would mean just plugging the subject in, like as a kind of a mechanism into a kind of mechanical universe that is determined by objective laws, rather than seeing those objective laws as subject to change. Right.
So. Right. Well, you know, I think that if there's a couple of things going on here, so let me just articulate what I'm hearing as the critique of my video and of Moish Bestone, and which I think is an influence as, along with the humanists on me. I know that they're both influences on me. What I'm hearing is, and maybe Lukács would be critical of Pustone and the humanists for the same reason that you're articulating. But when I think about our relationship to the laws of capitalism, say, or political economy, and our subjectivity in relationship to that, I think of it in terms of something like a chess player relating to the rules of chess, and there being a history of the game of chess. There have been openings that have been popular at certain times and not at others. The game develops. The rules don't change. They're very fixed, but the understanding of the game changes over time. What was the greatest player in the world might be, you know, completely feeble. And a new context where a new understanding has arisen about all the different ways you can move the chess pieces around the board. So there's still a realm of subjectivity for a chess player, but nowadays a computer can always beat every chess master. And Bobby Fischer used to complain that chess was really not a thinking man's game because it was all about memorization and not enough about creativity.
So let me just say, okay, this would be the problem. In other words, the difference between revolutionary politics and reformist politics is that reformist politics assume that the rules can't be changed, the rules of the game, whereas revolutionary politics is precisely about changing the rules of the game.
Right. But my feeling is that you have to understand the rules of the game that you're playing and what it's doing in order to be able to change them.
Of course.
If you're going to design a new game it's going to be coming out of chess, you have to understand.
Of course. No doubt about that. I would not. But again, right, the question is, how do we treat something like, for instance, from Moish Bestone, value theory? Right. Because I would say value has not always operated the same way. In other words, precisely Marx's point is to say that value has changed between cooperation, manufacture, and industry. So he doesn't expect Adam Smith to have his critique of value, because value was not operating in Smith's time the way it was in Marx's time after the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's like a major point that escapes most people. The idea that somehow value form has been there from the beginning, you know, the value form of the commodity, it's not the value form of the commodity that's at issue. It's the self-contradiction and crisis of the value form of the commodity that's at issue. Right?
Well,
that's
okay.
The issue.
I would agree with you that, I mean, to the degree to which, here's what I would say, to the degree to which in Smith's time, things were produced primarily for exchange, and you would bring creating a working class to do that work, whether it was, you know, through an industrial process or more with simple machines or just organizing people to do repetitive tasks that they would normally, you know, getting workers who might create a full object to just create a part of it in an assembly line, something like that. All those, you know, all those things are important, but the most important thing was the way things were being produced for exchange en masse. And so when you had a lot of small scale worker owners, and you were in like the mercantile period of capitalism, and you still had a whole lot of subsistence farming going on, you just didn't have the law of value applying to the whole of society and shaping the relations that you do.
I would say that the law of value isn't even operating at the level of exchange until, and this is Lukács's point, until it becomes total. It's not, And this is another point, which would be, there's no reason for Smith, for example, to regard value in this way as a total social system, to have a critique of value, because for Smith, it would be, we ought to treat labor as the source of all value. In other words, he's making a advocacy type of argument, whereas Marx is treating something that already exists and that has, you know, realized itself and has begun to abolish itself in his view. Whereas, you know, in Smith's view, of course, is not only of his own moment, but in retrospect. Because you could say mass production of articles for exchange has gone on since classical antiquity. Now, yes, it was maybe performed by slaves, in which case the owners would be the subjects of exchange, right? It wouldn't be the slaves who were the subjects of exchange. But I think you'd be hard-pressed to say that the value of labor then was the basis, right? It wasn't.
No.
Right? It would just be supply and demand, right? Whereas, why we come full circle, why after classical bourgeois political economy, why you get marginal utility theory in the late 19th century, you know, after Marx's time or contemporaneous with Marx, it seems to come full circle that labor was not value and is no longer value, right? So when capitalist economists say, you know, what's wrong with Marx and what's wrong with Adam Smith, by the way, is that they think that labor is the source of value, but it's not. And so perhaps it isn't, right? In other words, perhaps capitalism changes things such that value does not derive from labor the way it did, again, in the way that Smith was advocating it and in the way in which classical bourgeois political economy regarded it. And that would, again, be this strange reification. In other words, then value, when divorced from labor, becomes an objective phenomenon in a way that for Adam Smith it's not, or for Marx it's not, right? It's subject to struggle, right, for both Smith and Marx, because Smith talks about the conditions under which, the better social and political conditions under which labor can realize itself as value. right?
And well, I've always thought the reason the marginal utility theory became popular was because Marx's critique of political economy required revolutionary change, and if you were to hold on to any kind of labor theory of value, you would not be able to escape Marx. So it was not a
political economy. It's not so much you wouldn't be able to debate Marx, because I'm pretty sure that Bohm Bawerk didn't even know about Marx.
Right.
Right. So it's about, like, but it is, you know, in other words, wearing my Marxist hat. Mm. Of course, the capitalist bourgeoisie has to deny the basis of value in labor because it's a revolutionary theory.
Right.
What I would say is that it was a revolutionary theory for Adam Smith.
And right, but in a different way.
It becomes a liability in capitalism. Right. It becomes too explosive.
Yeah, right. I mean, the kind of equality that Adam Smith is advocating for is one which Marx can come along later and critique. But that doesn't make Adam Smith some sort of villain, or, you know,
I think watch out on the left, though. Watch out.
Right. I know. On the left today, Chris, if you say anything, watch out. I mean, you know, there's no position to take on anything on the left that isn't going to offend some sect or another. And maybe it will change moment to moment.
Where is the classical Marxist, by the way, like Rosa Luxemburg or Lenin? Mm-hmm. They had good things to say about Adam Smith.
Sure. If you read Reform and Revolution, it's amazing how at times she sounds like Milton Friedman.
Because Milton Friedman is right.
Yeah.
He's right against the Keynesian Fordist welfare state. He is.
Well, what I would say was he was concerned about distorting capitalism and distorting the market in a way that seemed similar to Milton Friedman, and it just for very different reasons than Friedman would be, because she thought that the more distorted things became, the less empowered the working class would be, because if capitalism was functioning relatively well, I think if I'm remembering correctly, that meant that the workers would be able to make more demands.
Yes.
And there would be fewer reasons to immiserate them, and they would suffer fewer attacks. And
I mean, of course, the Marxist point, though, people like Luxemburg, was that that's increasingly not the case. In other words, the accumulation and concentration of capital and the political consequences of that, in imperialism and the Bonapartist state, meant that, of course, there's a general tendency towards the disadvantageous position of the working class in capitalism.
Right. But I mean, just a few moments ago that you were saying that today, in fact, the labor theory of value no longer really shapes put it a different way. The labor time embodied in commodities no longer dictates the terms of exchange, and is no longer beneath the surface, the foundation of capitalist society.
So this is my critique of your video. Yeah. This work, we've come around to it, which is labor as a commodity, labor power as a commodity, and labor time as measure. Mm-hmm. Three different things. So why does Marx distinguish those in order to establish a contradiction between them? In other words, labor and labor power are dialectical categories. The distinction between labor and labor power is not simply one of analytic specificity. It's because the nature of the commodity has changed. And in fact, in the exchange of one's labor power as a commodity, one acts as if one is exchanging one's labor as a commodity.
Which one isn't.
Right.
Which I point out in the video.
So it's not like, okay.
But Adorno says the opposite, which is why why I made the video.
Exactly. So that's why I had to say, oh, poor Adorno. In other words, when Adorno says in The Elements of a Critical Theory of Society that he's going to say something heretical here, he knows exactly what he's doing. Mm-hmm. In other words, he knows exactly the stakes of that. He's not saying, oh, I'm just differing with Marx. He's saying it looks different to us now than it did in Marx's time. Mm-hmm. And that this is, in fact, that Marx's critique eludes us, kind of slips away from us, precisely because the kind of contradiction that Marx saw manifest, not just, you know, that he analytically gleaned, but that he saw manifest, especially in the class struggle of the working class and struggle for socialism, was no longer apparent, right? Was kind of buried. Let me just say something about labor time. So labor time is measure, and of course this is where Moish Piston's work places so much emphasis. There's a contradiction between the commodity as labor and the commodity as labor power. There's a self-contradiction in labor time as measure.
The commodity as labor power is wrong. The commodity, broadly, isn't labor power. Labor power is a commodity. That's not the same thing as saying commodity is labor power, because every commodity is labor power.
No. What I meant was the commodity that the worker exchanges with the employer.
Right.
But
all commodities gain their value from real living labor, but not all commodities are equivalent to any amount of labor power.
Yes. Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Go ahead.
For instance, Adorno will use this language that drives people crazy, the law of exchange, right? And then someone like Moish Piston will say, well, Adorno thinks that the problem is just exchange.
Well, and Pollock thought that the problem was primarily just exchange, and Sohn Rethel thought that as well. And Hilferding seemed to think that to some degree or another. And Kowski picked up a little bit of that as well. And it's a convenient thing to think if all you want to change is the property relations, basically taking it out of the hands of competing capitalists and putting it into the hands of the state. So that's why.
I mean, we've talked about this before, I think, to say that the beginning of addressing the problem would be the expropriation of the private property of the capitalists. Mm-hmm. In the means of production. But that also means expropriating the property and the means of production of the working class.
It does.
Right. So in other words, it means that individuals are no longer free to dispose of their labor power. But that's already the case in capitalism.
Yeah, true.
Already the case in capitalism. And also for the capitalists. In other words, state management of capitalism has been a reality, and a specific reality. You could say that it's been there, you know, from the very beginning, from Renaissance Venice or something, but in a very specific way in the 19th century, after the Industrial Revolution, right? The state plays a managing role. Defending the interests of all the capitalists, or of collective capital, more precisely, against individual capitalists. And collective capital, by the way, that's the working class too.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the idea being that the workers will only accept a formal abridgment, as opposed to a substantial abridgment in capitalism, but a formal abridgment of the right to dispose of their labor power as a commodity in the dictatorship of the proletariat, on condition that they have a political say in that process.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Makes sense to me, yeah.
So, you know, but again, that doesn't solve the problem of capitalism. It raises it to a political level.
Right. And from my perspective, at that moment, when the working class has a political say in how they're going to expropriate and transform capital relations, there's a moment where the test is really. Are we prepared to make that transformation or not?
We don't know. And
right.
The Soviet Union doesn't tell us anything about that.
I can say that I don't see many signs that there are even dedicated Marxists who are thinking very much about that transformation, about what's needed. And certainly the working class movements I know seem to be pretty much mired down in what Lenin would call trade union consciousness, at best, you know.
That you're talking about,
yeah,
that is Lukács calls it, in the standpoint of the proletariat, the completion of reification. meaning the dictatorship of the proletariat is the completion of reification.
Okay, now explain that to me. Why is that the case for Lukács?
For Lukács, because he thinks that essentially, the workers' councils, the dictatorship of the proletariat is the ultimate sort of, we might say, self-reification of the working class, meaning it's the ultimate expression of the divorce of the working class as political subject and as political economic object, right? So the working class is going to administer itself as an object. You know, Engels has that wonderful phrase where he says the governing of men will become the administration of things. What's wonderful about that phrase, and that escapes most people, is its dialectical character. Because, of course, human beings are things, too.
Hmm.
Right? So, in other words, and the point being that that is not the end of the story, meaning what Engels is describing there, Lukács would regard as the ultimate completion of reification. And then beyond that, you would be beyond, and this is something that I've written about in some of my essays on philosophy and Marxism, you'd be beyond the subject-object dialectic. In other words, beyond capitalism would be beyond a subject-object dialectic. And this is why postmodernism, Heidegger, object-oriented ontology, thing theory, that's the kernel of truth to all that shit. Because otherwise that's just shit, right? Or like a Deleuze kind of perspective. It's pretty crappy. But what it does do is it expresses a desideratum of emancipation, which is maybe we don't want just the realization of the subject-object dialectic in some kind of apotheosis of Hegel. Maybe we want to get beyond that.
Yeah, but Hegel's absolute though has to be raised here. Trying to understand what Hegel meant by the absolute at the end of the phenomenology, I think comes up for me when I hear you talk about the completion of reification. Because one of the things at the end of phenomenology that has to be accepted is that, for there to be an existing society, say, injustice is going to be part of it. That acceptance of the responsibility of both sides of the subjectivity of the subject of the to put it differently, the authority of the subject. Like the king's subjects, you know what I mean? The authority that they actually have, as well as the responsibility that the king has, that both of them can, from different perspectives, cannot self-justify their decisions, but that there's an act of, kind of an unjustifiable act that must be accepted. That's part of, I think, of what is at the end of the phenomenology. To put it differently, like the necessity for mediation or for reification, to naturalize what you're actually creating is going to have to be a part of the creation of a new society. We can't create a society in which everything that we try to create is immediately stripped away and every kind of relationship that we have is undermined. We're going to have to naturalize our relations. We're going to have to set up a new system of production, say, and distribution. If we put it in terms of chess, we'll create new rules. We're not going to create a game without rules.
Well, right? We might.
Okay.
In other words, okay. we might not be creating a game. In other words, society. So before bourgeois society, before capitalism, certainly. There really wasn't society. So Adorno says society is a concept of the third estate. What there was a divine order, a great chain of being, castes, and each caste had its own laws, its own rules, its own game. And they did not map easily upon each other, which is why in Christianity they could say God works in mysterious ways, meaning, the rules of peasant life, the rules of artisanship of various kinds, different artisans played by different rules, right? Had a different metaphysics of materials. So the metaphysics of stone is different from the metaphysics of metal and the metaphysics of wood, right? in their view. And of course, the aristocracy, the nobility, play by their own rules. And, you know, it all fits together in God's plan, but you know, who knows how that exactly works, because it doesn't, right? It's clear, right? So the medieval theologians, it's like, you know what? The soul doesn't quite make sense, but it doesn't have to. It makes sense in God's mind.
Right.
In bourgeois society, we try to make it make sense. We try to say there is such thing as society. There are social relations. And this is why the postmodernists are like, what is this totalizing bullshit? There are no social relations. There's just heterogeneous things that just exist. No, there are social relations precisely because we have taken various human activities and called them one thing, labor.
Right.
That's what makes society society. Beyond capitalism may not be society. The unfortunate thing being that the only way we can try to imagine that is some kind of reversion to pre-bourgeois society, to the heterogeneity of caste civilization.
See, I think it will be society after that. We will still be. Here's why. We capital has brought us together in an interdependent relations. We brought the mass of men together to create a world together rather than have this hierarchy of wood and silver. And, you know, we're now equalized, flattened out, but also forced together to create a project as a species, as a
people. Be careful about that, though, Doug. Humanism. Be careful about humanism.
Because I like humanism. I'm a humanist, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm not. And okay. The reason that I'm not is because, and again, this is where some of the more sketchy stuff from the Frankfurt School that people don't like comes in, which is that social relations are a cosmology, meaning they're not only a relation between human beings, they're relations between human beings and nature. And in a religious cosmology, right, we relate to nature in religious terms, meaning it's all God's creation. So it's not just a relation between humans, it's also a relation between humans and nature. And nature becoming subject, right? So in religion, nature is a subject, meaning it's God's creation.
Yeah.
Beyond capitalism, right, maybe we're going to be beyond, and of course we already are beyond, simply a relation between human beings. Right. This society is a relation between humans and nature, too. And that relation is one of labor, one of production. We treat nature as an object of production, as an object of transformation through our labor. Maybe we will relate to nature entirely differently beyond capitalism.
And
in which case the category of the human can go out the window. Meaning there will be a Homo sapiens species, but there's no reason to equate the subject of freedom, not society, but of freedom, to the human species, to Homo sapiens. And again, that's why it's Francis Fukuyama, our post-human future, there's a kernel of truth to all this stuff. Come on.
Oh, yeah, I know. Right now, Alex Jones is screaming in the back of my head that, oh, I knew it all along. The communists are trying to destroy humanity.
Yeah, he's the last bourgeois humanist.
Well, you know, no.
If you were a bourgeois humanist, you'll rip your shirt off and beat your chest. You know, you'll be Alex Jones.
Right. I understand you. I do agree, actually, that when I'm talking about bringing the world together, and bring the people of the world together to create a common human project. I may be.
That's the bourgeois project. That's already happened.
Right. But but overcoming reification means that now we get to set the terms of that project.
Yes. But what I'd say is that that's already happened and we've already gone beyond it, meaning it's in crisis. The common human project has happened. It's become self-contradictory. It's entered into crisis in capitalism, which means we're not going to put it back together. We're not going to restore bourgeois humanism. We're not. Capitalism is wrecked. It's gone forever. We're not going to restore it, although, paradoxically, the struggle for socialism can look like the struggle to restore bourgeois humanism. But we have to be careful about that, right? And this is the kernel of truth to Althusser, who otherwise I can't stand. When Althusser is like, we can be humanist propagandistically, but not theoretically, right? Mm-hmm. Sure, right?
What do we mean by human? Like, I feel like the Cartesian subject, okay? I know now I'm really...
Maybe the subject is the machine.
Well, sure. But it's still a Cartesian subject, even if it's a machine.
I know, because there's no artificial intelligence, and there's not going to be either.
Probably. Well, there might be an artificial intelligence.
There will be machine learning.
Right. But I mean, let's say data existed, right? I would then say, well, if data is a subject, then data is a Cartesian subject like anyone else, like he, that, which means that, you know, the foundation of his subjectivity would be doubt and a sense of distance from the world and self-reflection rather than foundation being some positive.
Right. Statistical, what right. Lukács calls the reduction of the world to statistics.
Right. So the point that I'm making is I'm glad to expand the human subject to some sort of possible future subjectivity that might be beyond what we think of as human today in the specifics. Like
we might machines loose. We might say, you know what? Yeah, we want to reach out to Alpha Centauri. Yo, machines, why don't you do that?
Right. Right. Yeah. But that would still be part of a human project.
Say you make the decisions about how to do that.
Well, we would program it as to how. That's the key overall. That's the key now under capitalism is the programming of how decisions and the framework for decisions more than the individual decisions themselves.
We wish there were. There is no program.
That's where you and I disagree. There is. It's based on the labor theory of value and the time spent producing commodities. And it's like a game of chess. It's very, very complex.
No, you can
work out the rules.
No. This is where we wish it were the case. We wish it were the case. What Lukács says in that Phenomenon of Reification piece, he says, to fully understand the laws of value would be tantamount to overcoming value itself.
Right. So let's do it.
Well, you can read that romantically the way Moshe Postone does. And you could say, well, he just wants the subject to master the rules, whereas the point is to abolish the rules. Postone. I actually think that Lukács is interested in abolishing the rules. In other words, the dialectical conception is that you understand something after you've overcome it.
Right. No, yeah, I agree. So one consequence of understanding the rules of the labor theory of value would be to realize that under capitalism, while you're producing commodities, there can be no such thing as full employment.
It's a false necessity we're living under capitalism. However, that false necessity shouldn't be replaced by like a true necessity or something. You know, like
no, it's just a better false necessity. A better false necessity that we recognize on some level is false, but nonetheless reify or naturalize enough to survive.
I would say it happens on the humanist side too. Like production for human needs, not for profit, reifies needs. In other words, it says we know what human needs are.
Oh, yeah, right. I agree with you.
We don't, right? In other words, the whole point would be to transform what human needs are.
Yeah, we would have to realize that with a new form of production, there would be new needs. Absolutely. So we would be responsible for both setting what seems like needs and for
who's this we?
The working class.
Well, only in the dictatorship of the proletariat. Meaning, beyond the dictatorship of the proletariat, the working class abolishes itself. What that means is that there is no working class anymore.
Humanity, okay? We have to label it something. Yeah, humanity, then.
The Homo sapiens might be doing things in their activity, concretely, but also abstractly, that are incommensurable with each other. In other words, you might have what Moshe Postone calls the dissolution of the capital S subject by the small s subjects, right? In a way that postmodernism wants, but he calls it premature post-capitalism. You know, meaning maybe we do want that. Maybe we do want, and basically all that you'd have left is some like fundamental, you know, kind of respect or something, but it wouldn't be undermined the way it is now by the destructive race to the bottom of capitalism. So capitalism, you know, is constantly making commensurable what is incommensurable. And that doesn't mean commensurability is the problem, but it does mean maybe we don't need commensurability anymore. Maybe we don't need to make all our various activities commensurate, because beyond material scarcity, there's no particular reason why, like collective decision-making. Okay, where are we going to allocate our resources? Well, resource, the very notion of a resource or a kind of finitude of resources would be qualitatively changed. In other words, we already do this. We create new resources. We don't just deal with a fixed amount of resources, you know?
Well, we look, behind me is... I'm going to point to my, this is my capital. I wrote a young adult-ish novel and where I tried to work out what it would mean to overcome commodity production. And I used an AI to do it. And the way it worked in my future dystopia, okay, was that.
Isn't it Aldous Huxley dystopia or a 84 dystopia?
Oh, it's Huxley. Yeah. Yeah, it's everyone gets to play the video games of their choice in augmented reality, whether they like it or not. There's an AI that's sort of leading them along. Once you put on the goggles, you get stimulated to like it a lot, say, right?
Kind of like the Matrix.
Yeah, it's like the Matrix, absolutely. Only you're in augmented reality, so the things you're doing are also producing the things that other people might want to do. Mm-hmm. So like you're playing Frogger, that's setting up the production needed for a game of Pac-Man over here. Okay. So and the what gets made is based on what the video game people want. What do they want to play? Well, what they want to play then has to be made so the AI directs the activity so that what they desire most will be able to be played next. And
in other words, the kind of collective resource that people are contributing to independently.
Right. But not necessarily through a process of politics.
No.
It's through a process of seeking out their desires, which are very strictly limited. You know, like this guy doesn't get to have a girlfriend anymore. She doesn't exist. She's now, tomorrow she'll be Q-Bert. The next day she'll be something else. Because
that's the dystopian part, right?
Right. Yeah.
Well, here, this is the other thing about like the subject, right? And so there's Homo sapiens, there's the species, but there's also the individual human being.
Right.
So we are, in a way that was not necessarily true before capitalism, before bourgeois society, we are legal juridical subjects, meaning we're accountable for our past actions.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps not. Beyond capitalism. In other words, perhaps beyond capitalism, you know, the individual human being would be fungible, transformable as a subject, such that we would not hold them accountable for their past selves, if you will, right? That you can, and that you wouldn't have to relate to others as an individual, right? That you could relate to others in various ways.
That seems pretty terrible to me.
Why would that be terrible?
Because I think we lose a lot. If we
already do that, though, Doug, we already relate, you know, I teach this to my social worker PhD students in terms of social construction theory, which is that we all show up with others in various guises of the self, meaning I am Chris Catrone with Doug Lane, perhaps different than I am Chris Catrone teaching at the School of the Art Institute or Chris Catrone at a platypus meeting, right? And so why is there one Chris Catrone? Because, you know, I want my bank account to remain the same. And obviously my debtors want my, you know, what I owe them.
I operate under the fiction of a unity behind the plurality of Doug Lane. Like, you know, I, and it gets me in trouble sometimes. Like you should, you know, because like if I'm having a conflict with my wife, I might want to sit her down and explain it to her in terms of critical theory or something. And that always goes wrong.
That's not going to work.
Right.
Because you are who you are with your wife.
Right.
And that's not who you are for zero books.
Right. No, I know. So that's right. But I nonetheless like to think that there's some sort of behind all these levels and maybe with
different
my wife.
Relations. This is what we're talking about. In other words, there
maybe
won't be
with
a
my
social
wife is
relation.
The one that's the most authentic or the most unified. No, I know.
There really isn't. there, like in actual, again, you know, why I brought up teaching psychologists, you know, doctoral students in psychology. They know this as a function of their profession, meaning psychology is such that you can't pin down who the real person is.
But that's troubling to me.
No, it's contextual, it's situated, it's concrete. Again, the abstract individual versus the concrete individual. The concrete individual is actually a proliferation of individualities based on given relations.
But I feel as that deep down as a Cartesian subject, say, or as an existential subject, I have a responsibility to take all these different versions of myself and get them to relate in such a way in which there's as little hypocrisy and as little conflict.
That's not Descartes. That's more like Sartre.
No, I said I switched it over to existentialism. Started with Descartes and then went to existentialism because I don't think they're really in opposition.
Kierkegaard knows that that in God's mind we're not just one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That we're not the Leibnizian monad.
No, right. But nonetheless, we have an ethical responsibility to create at the very least, now we do.
We certainly do now, right? All that I'm saying is the postmodernists might be right. Mm-hmm. That we might want to lose ourselves beyond capitalism. Sure. And in fact, capitalism itself already does this. I mean, you got to find it entertaining. Did you ever look at the right wing?
Yeah.
Like the avowed right, not the left, which is actually right wing, but the avowed right. So many of these people have invented personas. They've changed their names. They've reinvented themselves. They've gotten plastic surgery. Like, it's amazing. You know, these political operatives on the right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could say that's shameless opportunism, and that, of course, characterizes the right. But it's also politically quite savvy. In other words, it gets the job done. You know, as opposed to the left that might think, okay, I'm authentic, in which case, like, your college essay is going to be held against you in your subsequent right. political career, right? The right is like, no, that person doesn't exist anymore.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
Because capitalist ruthlessness demands that it no longer exist. And that's true. Right? And that doesn't mean we're going to restore some authentic self.
Well, okay. I don't want to claim that authenticity is in of substance, and like an authentic substance is what I think we need to reach.
I'm not
for,
against but, authenticity, by the way, right?
But I'm thinking that human freedom has to be dialectically related to a responsibility around some sort of value that we have to collect.
Insofar as we actually can be held responsible. You know, that's why the radical prison abolitionists, like the decarceration people, they are like, you know, maybe we should give people a second chance. You know?
Hey, you know, do you have time for a little, like another session if I took a quick break? Would you do that? Because what I want to do is in the parrot room, I'm calling it, talk to you about Trump and the election. Because this question about the courts leads directly into that.
I was just about to say, let's see what happens when Trump's out of office, right? Let's see how ruthless the capitalist bourgeoisie is politically with its own.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. Okay, so let's take 5 minutes or 10 minutes and I'll send you a link. Okay.
Sure.
All right. Cool. I enjoyed this, by the way, and so I'm looking forward to it.
Good.
Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.